he sighed, blinking. She kissed the scar. She lingered. Her tongue slid on his flesh. Then she stood again to face him.
You're stopping there,
he gulped. Something chimed. She took out her vox. My master summons me, she said.
Throne, really?
Really? She turned and picked up her hat. You shouldn't be alive, she told him. Carthay and Steel. You are one of a very select group, Harlan. What we call Huayla Esufaun, which means spared by the genius.
Will I see you again?
He asked, feeling foolish and 14 the moment he said it. Angharad smiled. The smile was predatory and thrilling to him. Always, she said. Then she pulled back the silk drape and vanished. Nail sat down. A servitor peered in through the drape. What may I fetch for you, master? It whirred.
An amasek, a large one, and also a fresh shirt, he replied.
Chapter 6
The hobbled bastard was right then, muttered Inquisitor Fenks. You have to hand it to him.
You do. You really do, replied Balak. Here all the time,
Fenks continued. He slid down out of the halted carriage into the gloomy side street.
And we laughed at his hunch.
Ravenna is old and experienced,
Balak said, clambering out to join Fenks.
What was it he said? He has faith.
Balak spoke the word as if it was dirty.
He knows his business.
I will have to make my apologies to him,
Fenks decided.
Glory, Mizard will have to make her apologies too. Now I understand why he's so highly regarded.
Fenks looked at Balak.
Provided, of course, that this is confirmed. This is confirmed, I take it.
The intelligence is immaculate, said Balak, gathered from 8 separate spy units and corroborated by gene sensors. Moloch is here.
We have him cold?
We have him cold, sir.
Fenks torched up the power to his black body armor. There was a whine, gathering in pitch. Green signal lights lit off around his high collar. He unshipped his bolter and racked it twice.
Bring them up, he ordered.
Interrogator Balak nodded. The others dismounted from the waiting carriages.
Dhamal Singh and her gunhounds, Sugurth, Claudel, Mentator. Where's Angharad?
Fenks asked.
On her way, she's signaled.
Fenks shook his head.
We can't wait for her, not with the target in sniffing range. We commence.
We commence,
Balak called to the waiting figures.
Not like that,
grumbled Tarkos Mentator, the old savant. He hobbled forward on his cane.
Not with firearms.
What? Fenks spat. Mentator shrugged, as if in the most humble of apologies. He aimed a palsied hand at the dark building before them.
Your prey, sir, has made his nest in a house of generation. Public generation 987, to be accurate, serving the western district of Bastine. Quite apart from the power cells contained in this place, there are volatile chemicals held in suspension. Use of firearms would be a very bad idea.
Because?
Fenks asked. He caught himself. He was sounding stupid.
Because we'll blow ourselves to hell, right? Thank you, savant.
He holstered his bolter.
Muzzle your firearms, he ordered, drawing a short, curved sword.
Claudel put away her plasma pistol and pulled out 2 bloodletting sickles, 1 in each hand. Cursing, Sugurth patiently detached his cannon from his shoulder socket, put it back in the carriage, and hefted up a war axe with a long, knurled grip.
Guns, no,
Dhamal Singh instructed her whining hounds. Their weapon systems deactivated and withdrew.
Teeth, good,
she said. They chomped and clacked their razor-edged jaws, growling. Balak had drawn a rapier and a matching poniard.
Commence,
snapped Fenks, walking towards the building.
Bonus pay to the one who brings me Moloch's head.
The corpse lay face down in the dark on the cold steel decking.
Where did you procure the cadaver?
Moloch asked.
It's the Inca you killed,
Vorna said.
We needed a body, and we had one lying around. Not a great likeness, but then who knows what you look like anymore?
Will it suffice?
Lucius Vorner, massive and massively scarred in his chipped power armor, nodded.
I had it typed and matched to your gene, palm and retina. They won't know the difference. End of story?
Moloch asked the giant bounty hunter. Vorner smiled.
End of story.
That sort of typing and gene scripting costs dearly,
Layla Slade said.
It costs what it costs,
Orfeo Kulzean replied.
Are we all ready? Zygmunt, you know how this has to work. I know, Orfeo. I truly know. Consider this recompense for my mistake. I will. I do. But Balak... Leave Balak to me,
Moloch replied. Warning runes lit up on Layla Slade's Auspex grid.
Door 4 and door 7, she hissed. Here they come.
She rose in one fluid movement from her cross-legged position on the deck and drew a stabbing sword. Lucius Vorner moved forward beside her, a warhammer resting across his shoulder plate. Moloch stepped in front of them.
May I crave a favor? From you, Lucius, and you, Layla. May I do this? You'll need support,
growled Vorner.
No, I won't. But if I do, you won't be far away, will you?
Vorner shrugged, a tectonic gesture of his powered plate.
Let me do this,
Moloch insisted.
Let me enjoy this. Let him,
said Kulzean. Layla Slade grinned and offered the grip of her blade to Moloch.
I won't need that, he said.
He turned and vanished into the shadows. The House of Generation was very large, with a high roof and deep pockets of darkness. The main body of the hall was lined with generator hubs, throbbing in the half-dark. The light was violet, dim. Fenx's team moved in, whisper quiet, spreading out between the aisles of humming hub units, slipping from shadow to shadow. Bringing up the rear, Tarkos Mentator shuffled along on his cane. He let the others do the real work, the violence. He was only there to advise.
Bad place for a fight,
a voice whispered in his ear.
It is,
Mentator agreed lightly, then caught himself. He was suddenly terrified. Someone was walking along just behind him, just a shadow, just a shape at his shoulder.
I'm reminded of Perlingerius in the third act. The Choral Requiem,
the voice suggested.
What is it again? A man must choose his final resting place as befits his soul. Quite magnificent.
Ah, I see you know your Stradale,
Mentator answered timidly.
Know it well,
the voice replied.
You like opera, then?
I do.
So do I. Stradale, Jevioth, Carnathy, apart from the awful final works.
Oh, they are awful, aren't they?
Mentator agreed. Fear was almost choking him.
Are you afraid of me?
The voice beside him whispered.
Yes. Yes, I am,
Mentator answered.
Very much.
You want to cry out to the others, don't you?
Yes.
But you dare not raise your voice, do you?
No.
You know who I am.
I can guess.
I think you guess right, my friend. If you did cry out, well then, things would become very painful and awkward for you. But I'd hate for that to happen to a fellow appreciator of the operatic art. Why don't we just walk for a while, side by side, you and me? We could discuss Stradale some more.
Well,
that would be all right then, wouldn't it?
Yes.
They walked on a little further.
I'm about to be attacked,
said the voice calmly.
Try to remember not to cry out.
Mentator nodded. A shadow moved suddenly. Interrogator Claudel pounced on them from behind a turbine hub. Her sickles were swinging, flashing like ice in the gloom. They did not connect.
Claudel,
Moloch said.
What?
She faltered, robbed of action by the tone of command. His fingers stabbed into her throat, and she died. Molodge caught her falling body and carried it down to the ground gently. He picked up her sickles.
Oh, throne, you have slain her,
Mentator stammered.
Yes, I have.
Oh, throne,
his voice started to rise.
Remember what I said, Molodge warned.
Thanks, he's here,
Mentator yelled.
He's here!
Oh, dear me. I thought we had an understanding,
said Molodge. The sickles flashed. Inquisitor Fengs heard the savant's urgent cry cut off short. He ran back down the aisle of the turbine hall. Claudel lay quiet and still on the decking, as if asleep. Behind her, Tarkos Mentator was curled in a fetal knot, his robes soaked black with blood.
Throne,
Fengs growled. How did...
that happen?
Molodge finished for him. Fengs swept around at the sound of the voice, but his sword sliced into empty shadows. Misdirection was Moloch's favorite game. He threw his voice well. There was a blunt crack of bone. Fengs staggered backwards, bumping sidelong into the nearest hub. One of Claudel's sickles transfixed his skull, the handle jutting up from the crown of his head. Fengs fell back against the hub and slid down until he was almost flat on the floor. He opened his mouth and blood trickled down his chin. The light in his eyes went out, and his face went slack. Molodge turned from Fengs's corpse as a wail of misery echoed down the aisle behind him. Damal Singh stood 20 meters away, the gunhounds at her side. She gazed at Molodge in anguish and hatred.
Murderer,
she gulped.
Murderer,
he echoed quietly, not for sense, but to practice the timbre of her intonation.
Kill, good,
she snarled. The gunhounds took off towards Molodge. They were heavy and powerful, their scrambling paws slapping on the deck, their iron claws scraping, their razor jaws opened.
Kill good,
Molodge murmured, getting a true measure of Damal Singh's palate and tone. Gunhounds of this model were voice-controlled, specifically keyed to their owner's voice pattern. A voice pattern he now used perfectly.
Down, good!
5 meters short of him, the gunhounds skidded to a halt and lay supine, whimpering, resting their chins on their forepaws. Molodge smiled. He saw the look of bafflement and horror cross the small woman's face. Confused, she was vulnerable to the tone command.
Damal Singh, he called out. Mute!
She opened her mouth to command her hounds again. No sound came out. She gaped, her jaw moving uselessly. There was no time to enjoy her helpless state. Molodge felt a presence at his back, heard a heavy step. The Ogryn. The Ogryn was coming up behind him. He had a second or less to react. Molodge threw himself forward between the gunhounds. The Ogryn's axe crashed down into the deck where he had just been standing. As he dived, he hurled the remaining sickle. Spinning, chopping through the air like a fan, the sickle flew in a horizontal arc and smashed Damal Singh clean off her feet. Her body landed on its back with a thump and a violent, loose-limbed bounce. Shugurth howled, yanked his axe head up out of the punctured deck, and charged. Molodge leapt up, rotating to confront him.
Kill, good,
he ordered in Damal Singh's voice. The gunhounds ploughed forward either side of him to meet the charging Ogryn. They slammed into Shugurth with an impact that arrested his forward motion and brought him down hard on his back. Then they were on top of him. To his credit, the Ogryn didn't cry out much, even though his death was drawn out and messy. Molodge turned and walked away from the sounds of slavering chops and cracking bone.
You can come out now, Balak,
he suggested casually. Interrogator Balak stepped into the open. His sword and dagger were both drawn.
Well, aren't you quite the psycho bastard?
Balak said, his longer blade rising to touch Moloch's throat.
I am. I really am. You can put that away, Ghoul. We're done.
Balak sheathed his sword with a nod.
Of course we are. That was just for show.
He flipped his dagger over in his other hand and tucked it into its scabbard.
It's all just for show,
Molodge agreed.
You are quite treacherous, Balak.
Balak bowed and smiled.
It is a matter of the most pleasant fraternal confidence. How did an alumnus of the Cognitae end up in the Ordos?
Moloch asked.
Where else could I do most good?
Balak asked.
Your efforts are noted, said Moloch. Now all that's left is to make this look convincing.
I'll make the report, of course. The others died trying to bring you down.
Naturally.
You have a corpse prepared?
Moloch nodded.
I left it over there,
he said, pointing to their left.
And it will convince the most scrupulous tests?
It will, especially given the fact it will be extensively burned. A stray shot during the battle.
Balak smiled approvingly.
That will conceal a multitude of sins.
Yours included,
said Moloch. He brushed against Balak so fleetingly, the interrogator didn't understand what was happening until it had happened. There was a metallic clack as the handcuffs locked into place. Balak suddenly found his left wrist cuffed tight against the casing of a turbine hub.
Moloch, what is this?
This is goodbye, Balak.
Moloch!
Balak screamed.
Moloch!
She reached the dark side street where Fenx's carriages were parked. There was no sign of anyone around. The last message she had received had informed her that the team was deploying into the House of Generation across the street. Something was wrong. Very wrong. She was getting only a dead response from her body-to-body comm. A trickle of dead air. Fenx?
Sir?
Vox static. Angharad stripped off the rest of her formal black dress, tossed it aside, and cinched tight the straps and buckles of the form-fitting leather armor she was wearing underneath. Her clan armor. There was no time to find the cloak. She eased the Carthayan steel out of its long case. She prowled across the empty street, the steel in her hands quivering like a diviner's rod. Overhead, the stars were cold smudges of light in a purple sky. Two of Tancred's moons were aloft, both claw shapes. Killing moons. A good omen, or a bad one, depending on who survived to see the following sunrise. Under the eaves of the great building, it was as black as a cavern. She heard a distant sob from within, a stifled croak of pain. She pushed open the outer door and immediately smelled blood on the close air inside. Avizarek smelled it too. Holding the long sword in a tight, raised grip, she stepped across the threshold and made her way into the turbine hall. Silence. Darkness. 10 seconds later, with a catastrophic roar, a tidal wave of boiling golden flame blew out through all the windows and doors. Chapter 7. Kara had walked the long way around, through the recreational gardens where the gentlewomen of the city came in their long dresses and tall hats to sit under the trees and make civilized conversation around the ornamental lake, and up through the patchwork of lesser shrines and chapel houses where the pilgrims queued. The Temple of St. Carol sat on a shelf of dark volcanic rock at the western edge of Bastine, a white dome rising above the mosaic of red brick buildings in the bright afternoon heat. Priests were calling the faithful to worship, and peddlers were hawking their votive trinkets from handcarts. Ritual banners hung limp against an indolent yellow sky. She entered the temple through the western porch and walked around the back of the vast church, relishing the stone cool. A small congregation was gathering at the altar rail, and their voices were muted echoes in the magnificent, spacious emptiness, motes of human life in a giant cave of stone. She went through into the side chapel, a round chamber set off from the main body of the temple, where candles fluttered on a brass stand below high windows. She knelt at the rail and addressed a quiet prayer to the god emperor. It still seemed strange to her that she had found her faith again after so long. These days she felt incomplete if she didn't go to temple or make some devotion regularly. Belknap had reawakened the need in her to begin with, but it was more than that now. She touched the silver aquila he had given her.
"Why here?" asked Carl Thonius.
She hadn't heard him enter. He didn't seem to have footsteps anymore. Hello, Carl.
Why here, Kara?
He gazed up at the arched, painted roof of the ancient chapel.
Privacy, she said.
It was a half-truth. Part of her had wanted to see if he could set foot in a place like this. Carl smiled slightly. He looked directly at her with amused eyes.
Privacy.
We need to talk, Kara said, rising to her feet. He feigned confusion.
About what?
Don't, Carl, she said. He frightened her, especially when they were alone together. And he knew it.
About me, I suppose, he mocked. It's all me, me, me with you, isn't it?
We're leaving Tancred, Kara said.
Yes, tomorrow.
That's what he told me.
Our efforts here are done.
We're returning to Eustis Majoris, a new start.
Of sorts? Why?
Kara hesitated.
Carl, I love you.
Like a brother,
I love you. Only like a brother?
Carl asked playfully. Do you annoy me and aggravate me? And most of the time I don't like you, but I would die for you.
So yes, like a brother. Well, that's nice to know, he said. I love you too.
He turned towards the doorway, as if to leave.
Are we done? I can't do this any more, Carl. Can't do what?
He asked, halting, but not looking back.
Lie for you. Lie about you. Cover for you.
Carl Thonius turned, slowly. He stared at her. He looked as if he might be about to burst into tears.
But you promised, he said.
There was such a plaintive tone in his voice. You made me promise. That's different.
There was no compulsion. I didn't pressure you.
You did. You have. And I can't do it any more. Thonius licked his lips and cleared his throat.
Really?
Really.
What are you saying?
He asked.
I can't lie to Gideon any more. I can't keep lying to him, to any of them. I owe them all too much to keep doing that. You asked for time, just a little time, to beat this yourself, and I gave you that. I shouldn't have done, but I did. I can't give you any more. We have to tell Ravenna. I have to tell Ravenna.
His voice diminished to a tiny whisper.
Just a little longer. Tiny bit longer. I beg you. Please. I have been working, researching. I have found things, charms and incantations. I have found wards and bindings that...
No, Carl. It's not fair on me. Actually, it's not fair on you either.
He can help you. If I tell him, he can help you.
He'll kill me, Kara. Carl said softly.
No, he wouldn't have a choice. I'm sorry.
He'd kill you, too, Carl said. There was a long silence. Plainsong began in the main chapel outside.
What did you say?
She asked.
Don't be naive, Carl said.
You've known all this time, and you've kept it a secret. You're tainted, too.
He'd kill you. He'd have to. He couldn't trust you ever again.
You are wrong, she said. Wrong on both counts. He'd help you, and he'd understand my position.
Would he?
Asked Carl, sarcasm straining his voice.
Let's review.
Inquisitor Ravenna's own interrogator has become the vessel of a warp thing. And not just any warp thing, but an apocalyptic demon of infamous prophecy. But Ravenna doesn't know, even though the secret has been right there for months in front of his nose. And, wait for it, the only other person who knows is one of his most trusted and oldest friends. Unless that story ends with, and the moment he found out he executed them both, it's not going to sit well when Ravenna is brought before the High Elders of the Inquisition Helicon. I mean, is it? She shook her head.
Do you want to die, Kara? He asked. That wasn't a threat. I'm not threatening you. Throne, I just ask the question. No, Carl, I don't. But I want to do what's right.
So do I, he said. He was scratching at his right hand. The hand. as if it was starting to bother him. So many rings wound around those fingers. Kara watched him, her heart rate rising. That hand.
It's hot in here, he said.
No, Carl, it's quite cool.
I'm hot.
He walked across to the chapel's stone basin and washed his face in the holy water. She was amazed the water didn't spit and boil on contact with his right hand.
I'm tired, he said, once he was done. I understand what you're saying, because I'm tired of it as well. The deceit, the fear, and, for me, the pain. It hurts, you know. I'm sorry it does. Every morning, waking and remembering, every night praying the dreams don't come. And they always do. Carl, listen to me. If I am cursed, Kara Swole, if I have evil ticking away inside me, then what kind of evil is it? It's been months, and I have controlled it. I have contained it. There has been no outbursts. No one has died. And I beg you to remember, on Eustace Majoris, the thing inside me, it helped. It defeated Moloch. Kara, it took the sickness out of you. It saved you. I know. Then what? I have to. No, no, no. Listen to me. I've thought about this a lot. I think it's a blessing. Please, Carl, don't try to turn this. Listen to me, he hissed. She closed her mouth. Sorry, he smiled. I didn't mean to snap, but I really have thought about this. To begin with, it was a problem. A dirty, nasty secret. I thought I would die. All I wanted to be was free of it, free of... Slight, don't say that word. He shrugged. Sorry, again. Sorry. Come closer. No, Carl. Come closer, he insisted, gesturing with his left hand. I won't hurt you. I couldn't. That's the point. I'm not excusing my state, but what if it's more than just a curse? I don't know what you mean, Carl, she said, stepping slowly towards him and looking into his eyes. He was crying for real now. Tears ran down his pale cheeks. He held out his left hand to her, and she took it. He pulled her very gently close to him. What if this is a rare thing? Something we've never seen before? I have a demon inside me, but it is subdued. Imagine that. Subordinate to my will, I own its power. But I am not in its thrall. I can use its power. You're fooling yourself, Kara whispered. What if I'm not? What if I have the fury of a demon at my disposal, the insight of the warp, but remain pure and true? What a transcendent asset would that be to mankind? What a miracle! Think of the secrets we could learn. I could be something our species has waited millennia for, a man with the mastery of demons, a rational man with true insight into the warp. Kara, the Imperium would change. The warp would no longer threaten us as such an implacable... Carl, Carl, please. How many other men have thought the self-same thing? Slow or fast, the warp is always poison. This is basic to our understanding. I applaud the fact you've kept it contained for so long, but you can't keep it in forever. I don't want to keep it in. Kara, I feel... I really feel that this is a momentous thing. A demon slaved to order. An ancient enemy turned against the darkness. You must give me more time. No, Carl, more time. I can do this. I have mastered it, and I can formulate that mastery so that others can do it too. We can change all creation, Kara. For the good of mankind, we can change thinking and change action and banish forever our fear of the dark. It's too late, Carl.
He sighed. He bowed his head.
Throne. You're right,
he said in a very quiet voice.
Of course you're right. I'm a fool.
Forgive me for all of this. Forgive me for putting you in this situation. You're right.
Carl,
I'll tell him, I'll tell him myself. Will you let me do that? Please.
Of course. I'll come clean. Make him understand it was me all along. I'll protect you. Just let me be the one to tell him. All right. Yes.
When?
Tonight,
Carl said. He smiled sadly.
Oh, Kara. The stuff you know.
He pulled her close, and they embraced in silence for a long time.
So, tonight?
He asked.
Tonight what?
That's when I'll tell him.
Tell who what?
She asked.
I'll tell Ravener all about it.
About what?
Now you see.
He grinned.
Isn't that better?
She laughed. She wasn't sure why.
What were we talking about?
Faith, he said.
Oh, yes.
Faith gives us purpose, and a mind without purpose will walk in dark places.
That sounds familiar. Is it a quote?
I just made it up, Carl said.
We should go back. It's late,
Kara said.
We should. I'm glad we had this talk, Kara. You are right to keep it private.
He took her by the hand and led her towards the door. Patience Kiss was standing in the doorway.
This is nice, she remarked.
What are you doing here? Kara laughed.
I was looking for you both. Your comms are off.
Sorry,
said Kara, adjusting her link.
How long have you been there?
Carl asked.
Long enough to wonder if Belknap should be worried,
Kiss replied. Kara laughed again.
Carl just wanted me to show him where I made devotion. I think there are stirrings of faith in our friend here.
Fancy, said Kiss.
It's true,
chuckled Carl. I've grown slack of late, and I'll never make Inquisitor without a good record of temple attendance.
Kara was just guiding me. I needed a little spiritual focus.
Patience Kiss nodded.
Don't we all? There's been a development.
What kind of development?
The kind you wouldn't believe. But Ravener has to tell you himself. He'd hate me if I ruined his thunder.
They walked towards the doorway.
What's that? Kiss asked.
Several curls of bent metal lay on the chapel floor beside the basin. Tiny bent scraps, like the remains of rings that had been split apart.
Just votive offerings, Carl said.
He took Kara's hand in his, her left in his right, and led the way out of the chapel. There were no longer any rings on his right hand. Chapter 8. When they arrived back at the house, evening was falling, and Envoy Mizard was just leaving. She stomped past them in the courtyard, flanked by two heavy weapons servitors, heading for her transport.
A good man you have there, she said to Thonius.
Ma'am, I've just been rendering my apologies to him. I won't underestimate him again. Get him back to Eustace, Interrogator. Get him back on the job. His mind can be uncluttered now.
As they walked up the steps into the house, they heard the engines of her transport growling as it trundled away. Nail, Plighton, Belknap, Unworth, and the manhound Fifelank were waiting in the inner hall. Kara walked up to Belknap and kissed him.
What's going on?
Where were you?
At the temple. What's going on?
I'm not sure, but Moloch is dead.
What?
Impelled by a powerful mind, the double doors at the end of the hall opened, and Ravener glided in to face them.
Sir?
Asked Thonius. It's done. We're done, Ravener said via his voxponder.
We're still leaving?
Asked Nail.
Yes, Harlan. We're still leaving. But we can leave happy that there are no more loose ends. Last night, three precincts away, Zygmunt Moloch was located, cornered and slain by Mizard's forces.
There was a general commotion. Nail smacked his raised palm against Kiss's.
So you were right,
Kara grinned.
I was right, Ravener replied. My hunch was correct. Moloch was here, just as I suspected.
I'm only sorry it wasn't us who claimed him in the end.
The bastard's dead,
Nail chuckled. He did a little dance that made Belknap and Plighton laugh.
I can't believe it,
murmured Kiss.
All this time. All this time, and now it's done.
It's over, said Ravener. We have no excuses any more. Eustace Majoris awaits. I'd like us to leave tomorrow as arranged.
Who got him?
Asked Belknap. It was a good question, and Ravener was surprised it was Belknap who asked it. The others fell silent. Ravener had swung his chair away. Now he slowly turned to face them. Balak, it appears. It was bloody at the end, so Mizard told me. There were losses.
Losses?
Nail echoed. He suddenly had the most awful sense of premonition. He felt sick. Fenks tracked him to a house of generation, said Ravener slowly. His voxponder fumbled with the pace of his words. The monotone made it all the more horrible. There was a fight. Moloch did for most of Fenks's people. Then a stray shot ignited the volatiles, and the place went up. Moloch's corpse was identified by Gene Fix.
Glory!
Thonius whistled.
Who died?
Fenks, Balak, Claudel, Ravener replied. The Ogryn, Mentator, the Gunhound Woman, and the Carthaean, Angharad.
Dead?
All of them. They were clearing out the house and making ready to head for the port or the transports. Ravener had gone ahead with Kiss, Belknap, and Kara. Sholto Unworth and his manhound had left earlier that morning to light the ship's engines. Frauke was traveling with Zale in a secure buggy. Porters were rolling the last of the luggage out to the carriages. Carl Thonius stood in the yard, finalizing their dealings with the tattooed letting agent. Harlan Nail did a last circuit, checking the empty rooms one by one.
Harl?
Hello?
Nail stuck his head out of the vacant room he had been inspecting. Maud Plighton was jogging up the staircase. She had a piece of paper in her hand.
Message for you.
Message?
Came in by closed vox about 10 minutes ago. Last thing Carl fielded before he shut the system down.
Nail took the slip from her and opened it.
Problem?
Plighton asked.
Why do you ask?
The look on your face?
No. No problem,
he said.
Get going.
Maud nodded and hurried away. He waited until she was gone, and then read the slip again. It was from an unrecorded source, anonymous. It read, Spared by the Genius. Nail stared at it for a long time. Then he took out his link. Part 2. The Witch House of Utokri. Chapter 1. The door is half open. The door is old and made of wood. A very ordinary old door in a very ordinary frame. It swings back and forth slowly on its hinges, pushed and pulled by a wind that comes from neither side of the door, a wind that comes from somewhere else. The door is waiting. The factor's name was Stein. This piece of information emerged early on in what turned out to be over 20 minutes of loquacious preamble. Stein liked to talk. It was part of his performance.
Stick with it.
Every factor they had made approaches to, every factor in every hall in Berinth, most likely, had his own version of the performance, some variation of the mercantile courtship dance, the wooing of the customer. It was all part of the purchasing experience. Customers expected it. There would be a warm greeting, a guided stroll from the reception chamber into the factor's display rooms, an offer of refreshments, and a steady, light flow of conversation leading to a more specific extolment of the merits and traditions of the hall the customer had chosen to patronize. Certain themes were developed by the factor, with practiced verbal skill, designed to snag in the customer's thoughts and stay there. Luxury, exclusivity, quality. The customer was, after all, going to spend a great deal of currency. And the customer wasn't a customer. That was too coarse a term. He or she was an emptor. just as the factor wasn't a salesman or a shopkeeper. There were standards of decorum in Berinth.
He's going on and on and on.
Stick with it.
Stein had met her at reception. The hall stood at the northern end of the promenade St. Jacob, an area of Uphive Berinth, densely and famously packed with noted hall premises. The deep street stacks outside were tiered with ooze-like walkways and black iron railings, and strung with thimble lamps, a cavernously dark place of rising black towers, some of which grew up through the hive's great armoured roof, like a sea urchin's thorns. He wore a patterned coat and a practiced smile. Reception was a wide, inviting vault, panelled in varnished wood. Stein had bowed and led her back through the show galleries into the main chamber of display. Pools of emerald light contained glass showcases in the gloom. The floor was panelled with bronze slabs, and centuries of footsteps had worn a bright patina pathway across them. There was a simple wooden desk, faced by some leather sofas, and he invited her to sit down. Stein talked all the way. His performance, it seemed, would be all about words. Some of the factors she had so far encountered favoured a discreet approach, or a humble one, or allowed the emptor to lead the conversation. He was prolix. He, said Stein, was the 90th Stein, uninterrupted, to serve in the post of factor for Stein and Stein's Hall. That was a legacy, a family business. Steins had been at Berinth for 16 centuries. The hall was one of the oldest, their marks amongst the most noteworthy in the sector.
Here, said Stein, you may admire the hall's marks on this trinket.
He held it up in front of a magnifying viewer for her to inspect. His hands were overly pale and well manicured, looming in the lens. The trinket had more pearls in it than some oceans.
The Stein mark. I see it repeated in stylized form upon your doublet coat,
the emptor remarked. Stein simpered, delighted that she should notice. He complimented her extensively on her eye and her intelligence.
I think he wants to marry me.
Shush. Stick with it.
Stein was very taken with this particular emptor. An elegant woman, well-dressed, moneyed. Custom had been slack in the last few weeks, with few clients of note delivered by ferry ship to inspect the halls. This woman was something different. She had taste. She was beautiful, if you liked that kind of thing. He was telling her a little more about the business, about the fact that he was not as accomplished in the lapidary work as his many brothers, which is why he was the factor. He left the skilled lapidary to his kin, who could assay and value, so he boasted, with their bare hands. But he sensed she was becoming bored. That happened. She had stopped sipping the amasek he had fetched out on a lacquered tray, and she no longer picked at the candied ginger in the little finger bowl. A good factor noticed these details. A good factor knew when to up the tempo and move the courtship towards the consummation of purchase.
"Are you looking for a particular piece?"
he asked, walking around the simple hardwood desk with its velvet panels. He took out his keys and opened the doors of the nearest plate-glass displays. Recessed fans murmured in the invisible ceiling of the chamber of display. It was a comfortable 22 degrees, with the right amount of humidity and airflow to keep emptors fresh and relaxed. Outside Berinth, it was a murderous 60 below.
"I am," said the emptor, sitting back on one of the leather sofas and crossing her long legs. "Or rather, a particular piece for a particular purpose. A society wedding on Gudrun. I won't use names."
"Of course not," the factor said with a bow. The emptor smiled.
"But the match involves some people of influence, of blood."
"I understand. The son of a governor subsector."
"My word."
"Oh, try to stay in the realms of reality, please."
"Shut up."
"Pardon?" asked the factor with a slightly bewitched blink.
"Nothing. I said my niece, the bride, deserves something special."
The factor bowed again.
"I do understand. And if I may make so bold, financially..."
He let the deadly word hang. She shrugged.
"Nothing less than a 250,000,
she said mildly. For the third time he bowed.
"Oh, ma'am, I have a few trinkets that may well please your eye and your taste." "I think I just made him very happy."
"Well, that's all he's getting. I'm not paying for a 250,000 crowns worth of anything."
Except information?
Except that. She kept her grin fixed. Oblivious, the factor began to lift red satin trays out of the display cases. Several servitors appeared from the shadows, took each tray as he lifted them out, and brought them over to her, holding them so as to display them. The servitors were old and worn, but of great mechanical quality. She realized that the hall cultivated a slightly worn, slightly Spartan feel, so that the pieces would glow by comparison. It was all very clever, very judged.
A design for the throat is always appreciated. These on the first trays are allochromatic zalachite with red gold. I have them in diamond, too. Cabochon cut is usually preferred. They're delicious. Or a jewel setting for the brow. Sapphire with opal and signet, black silver or chaste adamite are very sought after. This one is nice,
the emptor said. The factor came over, lifting the piece from its tray with a midwife's care. The jewels shone in the light. The lights above the desk were well placed to make jewels scintillate at that particular point in the chamber.
The chrysoberyl, yes, a favorite of mine. Note the glorious asterism. Would you like?
He asked, holding it up.
Please.
Glass, the factor called, and other servitors hurried forward, holding up looking glasses all around the client. The factor placed the necklace around the emptor's throat and fastened it. She admired herself.
Has she your colouring? I am somewhat paler than my niece,
the emptor said.
Then something with cygate or quaffire? Tourmaline, perhaps. I have a pendulock-cut tourmaline with the most stunning dichroic properties.
You know your business, sir.
She tried on three or four more pieces. The servitors held the looking-glasses perfectly still.
I worry, she said, at length. This is a nuptial gift. It should be for the groom as much as the bride. He is my brother's son, after all.
The factor paused.
And the bride is your niece?
Did I say that?
You said that.
You said that, I'm sure.
By marriage, I mean. You know how it is in the dynastic melee that is court life.
Court life?
Yes, she replied. Did I get away with that?
He's too awestruck to notice. Play up the court thing. He thinks you're anonymous nobility.
I really don't like to talk about it, the emptor said.
Of course not. Well, perhaps I can show you some of our ornamental settings. Horologs, rosettes, imperial aquilas. For aquilas, we favor gold and composites, and also organic gems. The oceans here on Eutocri produce the most iridescent nacre effects.
You have a charter to produce authentic aquilas?
We are imperial jewelers, of course, by appointment.
Show on, she said.
He displayed several more complex objects to her. Some were so valuable he had to silently lock the suspension shields around the desk while she admired them.
This is really stunning work, she murmured,
turning a piece over in her hands. She held it up to the light.
What do you call this property?
Birefringence, or double refraction,
Stein replied.
Oh, I can't decide.
The factor smiled warmly.
I just can't decide. I feel incoherent.
The factor's smile froze and became cold. What?
I feel incoherent. Can you help me with that?
The factor took the piece out of her hands and put it back on its satin tray.
Did I say something wrong?
The emptor asked, slightly taken aback.
Yes, I think you did. He's not happy. Make your apologies and get out.
We don't cater for that sort of thing here,
Stein said sniffily. You've been wasting my time. Perhaps you'd like to leave. The factor was angry with himself. It wasn't often he misread an emptor so completely.
I'm sorry, she said, rising. I didn't mean offense.
Please leave.
Stein spat. He took a control wand from his belt and waved it briskly. All the servitors retreated obediently back into the shadows.
Get out.
I meant no offense, she repeated. I'm sorry.
Your kind are always sorry, said Stein. I should report you.
Report me to whom? She asked.
Get out, Patience. Now. We can't afford an incident.
Stein turned to look at her. His face was hard, poisonous.
You come in here, into this distinguished hall, looking for access to that ungodly place. Stein and Stein does not do that sort of thing.
I have apologized. I have apologized sincerely, sir.
Patience. I should call the magistrates. Stein blustered. He waved the control wand he had taken from his belt again, reaching into the air for a hive hub connection. She heard the buzz of a handshake. Berinth Magistratum, I have you. The speakers on the desk warbled.
This is Stein at Stein and Stein. I have a...
There was a click as the link disconnected.
Hello? Hello, Stein said.
I've blocked his comm. Now, patience, please walk out of there. Stein, of Stein and Stein, tried his wand again. When he looked around, the woman had gone. She stormed out of the hall's reception chamber onto the iron-railed promenade. The hanging thimble lamps shone overhead with a feeble, pearly light. Instinctively, she allowed the stream of pedestrian traffic to swallow her up and carry her along. All around her were the rich and privileged of a double dozen worlds, strolling along, some bodyguarded, some carried in ornate litters, some sporting parasols or long trains.
Sorry, she said. I fumbled that.
It doesn't matter.
It does. It took me by surprise. His reaction. He was so angry.
Proud, that's all. We aimed a little too high, trying an imperial jeweler. We can learn from this. She threaded through the crowd and headed down a flight of iron steps onto a lower stack. It was quieter there. She stopped and leaned on the guardrail, gazing down into the deep interstack drop and the street levels below. She got her breath.
I'm off my game, Gideon.
You're not. You're fine.
I can tell when you don't mean it. I'm off my game.
Maybe you are, Patience. Would you like to talk about why?
I'm off my game because I can't stand this. I hate what we're being forced to do.
That's only reasonable. So do I. She sighed, let go of the guardrail, and started walking again.
How are the others getting on?
Much like you. They're not getting anywhere, although they're not quite as combative as you.
I said I was sorry, Gideon. What happened back there? The last few places I tried just got a bit cagey when the subject came up, but that... He was so venomous, as if I was a criminal.
As I said, I think we aimed too high. Stein and Stein is about as illustrious a hall as there is on Eutokri. The man felt insulted. His hall was insulted. The inference hurt him. Put it behind you.
I think you should switch me out for Kara. Kara would do this better.
Put it behind you. She had walked to the far end of the stack level, into the gloomy architectural cleft where the armored curve of the roof dome met the stack ends. There was a small and dingy dining house there, built into the eaves of the giant outer roof. It clearly catered for understaff and the utility personnel who worked menial jobs in the halls. The staff frowned and whispered at the sight of her fine, expensive clothes. She ignored them and sat down at a vacant table. Around her, household staffers, gig drivers, and stack gutters hunched over and murmured to one another.
"Mademoiselle?"
asked a maid in an apron, coming over.
"There is a good place a level up where you might be more comfortable."
"I'm comfortable here, thanks," said Kiss. "A caffeine, black, sweet, and an Amasek if you have it. Cooking will do."
"Yes, mademoiselle."
Waiting for her order to arrive, she rose again and approached the heavy shield plate that formed the north wall of the dining house. She touched the control stud, and the shield slid up. She looked out on the world outside through the thick glass. The black and fat-bellied slopes of Berinth Hive shelving away below. The ice beyond, under a broiling sky. The savage gales beat at the glass and bombarded it with ice crystals.
"We are criminals now, aren't we?"
"Patience."
"Oh, stop it. We are. I know it. Rogue."
"It's the only way we have left."
"I hate it, Gideon. And I hate the idea that he's still out there. I hadn't realized before, but when you told me he was dead, it felt like a weight lifting off me."
"I'm sorry. It felt that way to me, too, if that's any consolation." Kiss put her hand against the glass and stared out at the nocturnal blizzard. "However, Patience, we need to retain control. We can't afford to be seen. and I think you were about to pin that Stein fellow to his chair by his scrotum. She smiled.
At the very least. I am so sorry. I'm finding this hard. So, how are the others doing?
Maud and Carl have covered 5 halls between them. Nothing. Harlan has managed to secure us an underboat. Now Carl is off buying rings down in the Brash quarters.
Doesn't he have enough rings?
I don't know. I don't pay attention to such things. Can one have enough rings?
Not if you're Carl, apparently.
The maid returned with the order. Kiss went back to her table, drank the Amasek in one, and sipped her caffeine. It was too hot, and the Amasek had been rough. Cooking, definitely. She dropped a generous number of coins on the table and stood up.
What's next?
Can you handle another?
Yes, of course.
Only when you're ready. Exit and head up a stack, then along to your right. Corlys and Sequatar, lapidary. Patience sighed.
How do I look?
Beautiful.
Then let's go.
Wait. Wait, Patience. Sit back down. Drink your caffeine. I believe Carl has found something.
Chapter 2. Incoherent. Well, that's a different thing altogether.
Oh, how so?
Asked Carl Thonius sweetly. Down in the Brash quarters, in the low hive, things were more basic. The stacked depths were cluttered with dirty stalls and tented stands of soiled canvas, selling knock-off and bad-cut gems, trinkets, keepsakes, totems and charms. The air was smoggy from the oil-drum fires and stank of liquor and refuse. Bagpipes keened and drums beat. There were fire dancers, shucksters, loafers, and the constant shabby bustle of the hab classes and the migrant workers washing aimlessly back and forth in the low hive like rank water in a bilge. The stallholder glanced around to see if anyone was listening. He had one sunken eye from years of using a stubby jeweler's loop.
Seeing as how you've bought so many rings from me, my friend, let me tell you, coherence comes at a price. You have to be introduced for a start. You do. Have yourself an introduction. The halls expect that.
Can you provide such a service?
The stallholder laughed a phlegmy laugh.
Mercy, no.
He gestured around at his modest stall.
I'm Brash, born and bred. I don't move in those kinds of circles.
But you know the system. He nodded.
What's your name?
Thonius asked.
I am Lennox Yanville, sir,
the man replied. He was small and pot-bellied, with nimble hands. He smelled of pitch and polishing amalgams.
Well, Lennox Yanville, if I was to, say,
purchase that gorgeous lapis signet I wavered over,
would you confide in me?
I'd be delighted to, said Yanville.
Thonius produced some more large denomination coins and counted them out onto the stall's stained baize cover. Yanville picked up the signet ring and carefully wrapped it in a small piece of felt.
It's all about reward, you see, he said quietly. Palms greasing palms. The halls have an arrangement with the house. They have had for centuries. Some will admit it quietly, others deny it, but they all benefit.
How so?
Every single hall in Berenth pays a retainer to the house in return for coherent information about new seams, stone beds, and metal deposits. The jewelry business here is what Berenth is famous for, but it's just a byproduct of Berenth's heavy industry. The first halls to set up here in the old days made their profits from the spoil of the intensive ore mining. But no one these days is going to sustain a business on accidental finds. Neither do the halls have the financial resources to maintain comprehensive mining operations of their own. So they pay to know where to look, and then hire out the mining complexes to do spot excavations. Everyone profits.
It sounds very companionable.
Yanville shrugged.
The halls are very proprietorial about who gets access to the house. They vet. It's an exclusive service. But then, Throne knows, you have to be pretty exclusive to come all this way to go jewelry shopping.
How do they vet?
You need to find an agent. They're very exclusive, too. They don't advertise. A client hooks up with an agent. The agent takes them to an appropriate hall and makes an introduction. Then the client has to make a purchase, something pricey. Horologs are good, I hear. The purchase price is the hall's fee. The client then gives the item to the agent as a gift. Later, the agent sells the item back to the hall for a cut of the fee. The item goes back in the hall's display, and the hall's made a tidy profit.
Very neat.
Palms are greased, backs are mutually scratched. Everyone smiles.
So, find an agent?
Well, I might know something.
Palms are greased and backs are mutually scratched, eh? Said Thonius. That gold thumb ring there.
So Stein knew all about it? Asked Patience.
According to my source, they all do, said Carl. They just don't like to talk about it.
That little shit. He made me feel this big, and...
Because you weren't introduced, said Carl quietly.
He was sitting on the couch in the bay window of the chamber, admiring the new rings on his hand. The winter night ticked and rattled at the window panes behind him.
I've half a mind to go back there and shove a kine blade up his ass,
Kiss growled.
Half a mind is all you'll need for that,
said Balak, overhearing her as he walked in from the adjoining room.
We have to be careful.
Kiss turned slowly and glared at the interrogator. In the 2 months he'd been with them, he'd shown an unfailing ability to wind her up. She felt sorry for him, of course. Balak had been through an ordeal, and he'd lost the hand after all. He'd also shown credible initiative bringing the whole matter to Ravenna. Still, he was, as Kara might say, a smug little ninker when all was said and done, and far too pretty for his own good, with that long white hair and those iron-drive blue eyes. For once, he seemed to notice her displeasure.
"Sorry, Kiss," he said. "That was rude of me. It's just, sometimes I'm very aware that I'm risking my entire career doing this. No offense, sir."
"None taken," Ravenna replied, his voice issuing as an electronic monotone from his chair. "We're all risking our careers." No one spoke for a moment. The fire crackled in the grate and warmed the room, part of a rented suite in Berinth High Hive. The floor was a checkerboard of brown and cream wooden tiles, the walls panelled in dark umwood. The fireplace was an extraordinary porcelain frame, inlaid with silver and nacre shell. The logs spat and coughed. Kiss, Balak, and Thonius reflected quietly on their situation, each in their own way. Patience wondered what depths of worry knotted in Ravenna's mind.
"I realized why Stein's reaction upset me so," she sent.
"Go on."
"It wasn't that he made me feel like a criminal. It was that I am a criminal, and he forced me to realize what that means. Everything I've ever done in your service, Gideon, I've done in the knowledge that I'm serving the Emperor's ultimate will. But there's no legitimacy anymore."
"There will be. I will make the Ordos understand why I've had to take this course. We will have our sanction."
"But there isn't any right now."
The chair swung around from the fireplace and faced the three of them. They all looked up respectfully. "I have said it before, but for the record, let me repeat. When we are done, I will bring us to Mizard, to Rorken, if necessary. I will make account, and I will take the reprimand."
"I wonder who they'll send after us,"
Carl mused, admiring his rings again. He looked up at Ravenna.
"I mean, they're bound to send someone. Right?"
Balak sat down on a tub chair.
"Lilith. Mizard will send Lilith and a team. Lilith Apfaquan is good. She already has a black notation rating. We can only hope she doesn't have the first clue where to start looking. That means we can't make a scene."
He looked pointedly at Kiss.
"Fair point. It's been made already. No one needs to tell me again,"
Patience replied.
"So, Carl, where do we find this agent?"
Thonius was about to reply when the apartment's outer hatch slid open. Patience saw how quickly, how nervously Balak rose and placed his good hand on the grip of his pistol. It was Maud Plighton, a version of Maud Plighton at least. She looked strange, buttoned into a long gown of Parsigi lace and deep green silk. The material strained and bulged voluptuously. Her cropped hair and heavy makeup created the unfortunate suggestion of a man in drag.
"Nice to see you, too,"
she sneered at Balak, seeing his hand on his gun.
"Not had a good day, Maud?" asked Kiss.
Maud flopped down heavily on the nearest couch and yanked off her high, feminine shoes. She'd borrowed them from Kara, and they didn't fit well. Her feet were sore.
"Bastard things,"
she declared as she tossed them over the back of the couch.
"I'm sorry to say," she said, "I got nothing."
"It's all right, Maud," Ravenna replied. "We have a lead now."
"Oh, good,"
Plighton replied, getting up. In one ungainly upward drag, she wrenched her expensive dress off over her head. The dress was another Len from Kiss, tight and too short for Maud Plighton's frame. She wriggled the dress off her arms and headed out of the room in her support hose and whalebone corsetry. There was a considerable sense of pneumatic tension.
"Thank throne, that's off. It was throttling me.
I don't do posh." "You do it very well," said Ravenna. Plighton grunted dismissively from the next room and called out, "I do undercover, all right, but that was not a bit of me. I haven't had that many unfamiliar hands in my chest area since I was last assigned to Vice."
"Well, fancy," said Carl.
Plighton stuck her head back around the door and then lifted one arm and sniffed her armpit.
"And I stink. That's not high class, is it?" "I can't begin to tell you," Carl said.
"Is there a drink going?" Maud asked.
"I'll get you one," said Balak.
"Help me unlace this bastard corsetry, someone. I beg you. Preferably you, Patience, seeing as it's yours."
Smiling, Kiss walked across the room and followed Plighton into the adjoining chamber. Plighton leaned forward, and Kiss started to untie the laces. It was a struggle.
"Emperor, help me. I can't breathe. How do you wear this stuff, Kiss?"
"Well," said Patience smoothly.
"Here's that drink,"
said Balak, appearing in the doorway with a glass. He hovered.
"Here, in my hand," Plighton said. "I can't reach it when you're standing over there."
"I was just mindful of your..."
"I'm sure I haven't got anything you haven't seen before," Plighton said.
"No, just a little more of it."
"Oh, you wish," mocked Plighton, taking the drink and sipping.
"Yum, lovely."
"If anyone gets to go back to Stein and Stein," Kiss called out, tugging at the corset laces, "it's going to be me."
"I was hoping to participate myself," said Balak.
He had returned to the fireside in the neighboring room and was trying to secure his long white hair into a ponytail. It was a hard feat to accomplish with just one hand. Eviscerex had severed his left hand cleanly, and his wrist stump sealed in a black leather nub packed with micro-healing systems. It would be another month at least before it was ready for an augmetic graft.
"I would really like to serve, sir," he said. "I want to be useful."
"The pair of you, then," said Ravenna. "If that's all right with you, Carl." Thonius shrugged.
"I'm happy."
He rose to his feet.
"Can I help you with that, Gaul?"
"Thank you,"
Balak replied. Carl began to comb Balak's mane with his fingers to tie it up. "We'll wait for the others to return," said Ravenna. "You can get started in the morning."
"So what's keeping Nail?"
grimaced Plighton, as Kiss slowly released her torso from its confinement. Sleet whipped against the window panes of the ground-level hangar. The work crews had gone for the day, and the underboats sat there in their ice pool like grey sea beasts, sleeping. Only a few spotlights shone down from the iron gantries. Angharad made a soft noise like a sigh and rolled off him. They lay together in the dark for a while, listening to the patter of sleet.
"I'm glad you lived,"
Nail said.
"That's a funny thing to say,"
she replied, turning her shoulder against his chest.
"Is it?"
"Obvious, then.
You didn't need to say it. I felt how glad you were. Right then."
"We should get back,"
said Nail.
"Is that thing really necessary?"
she asked, nodding to the little psych block unit beside them.
"Yes."
"Why?"
"It's hard to explain. Ravenna, I don't want to hurt him."
"Hurt him?"
"You're so like Arianad."
"I don't understand."
"Forget it," trust me. I've come to know how hard it must be for Gideon to be the way he is. He's human, after all.
He has his mind.
Yes, but he has his memories. It's just a feeling I get.
That he wouldn't approve?
Maybe. It'd be like rubbing his face in it. If he had a face.
It was warm and dark under the vent panels. They made a bed of cold-weather furs from a locker.
We should go, she said.
She rose in one fluid motion and began to look for her clothes. She was silhouetted against the baize lamplight for a moment. He looked at her.
Maybe another 5 minutes won't hurt, he said.
Chapter 3 Waiting made Kara swole tense, and tension gave her a headache. At least she hoped it was the tension. She didn't want to think about the other possibility. She was alone on the Arethusa's main bridge, nominally on watch, although there was little to watch for. Most of the ship's systems were shut down and depowered, just enough juice running through the conduits to maintain basics. As soon as they had arrived at high anchor above Eutokri, Unworth had turned off the commercial transponder and deactivated the ship's carrier number and beacon. They had no wish to advertise their location, let alone their identity. Every 3 hours, automated systems lit up the Arethusa's Vox grid and allowed her to check in with the surface team. The silences in between were numbing. Naturally, if any problems developed, Ravenna could always summon them without waiting for the routine Vox check. Kara had made sure a lander was ready in the belly hold. She checked her chron. Another 45 minutes before the next check-in. She was fidgety. She tried a workout to shake it off, a little blade practice, but it hadn't done the trick. She had felt rusty, slow, her heart not in it. It had been a long time since they'd seen any combat. She had no lust for combat, but the discipline kept her sharp. The worst of it was, her mind was cloudy. She felt befuddled, and she wasn't sure why. She remembered Ravenna remarking on it back on Tancred, just before they'd left. Some comment about him sensing something on her mind. She could remember getting a little steamed about that, but couldn't recall why. Guilt, probably. She'd never told Ravenna about her illness, nor of its miraculous remission. She hated keeping secrets, especially from him. The cloudiness had been on her since then. Maybe that's what he had detected. Maybe that's why he'd asked her to lead the second team and stay aboard the ship as backup. Perhaps he didn't feel she could cut it as a principal agent anymore. Perhaps he was right, but she hated the feeling that she was being sidelined. She hated it almost as much as she hated the cloudiness. It was a nagging sensation, like the haunting awareness of a memory that temporarily refused to form. There was something on the tip of her tongue that just wouldn't realize itself. Of course, forgetfulness was one of the primary symptoms to watch for. She realized she was rubbing her temple with her fingers. She pulled her hand away. She got up quickly and walked off the bridge, down the echoing spinal corridor of the ship. Most of the Arethusa's 20-strong crew were sleeping, apart from a few running spot repairs in the enginarium. The old, wretched hulk creaked and groaned around her. The walls were scabby and decayed. Unworth's vessel was neither a beautiful nor a reliable machine. She heard Belknap's voice, picked up her pace, and then slowed again, realizing he was in conversation. Through an open hatch, she spied him, sitting in the forward communal, on the other side of a table from Sholto Unworth. They were chatting and drinking glasses of dry Thracian muscal. Belknap got on with Unworth better than most of them, with the exception of Kiss, who had bonded with the little shipmaster during the perilous hours in Petropolis, and now deflected the worst of the teasing the likes of Carl and Nail dished out at Unworth's expense. Belknap got on with everybody, of course, because medics usually possessed that reassuring knack. But Belknap and Unworth were both outsiders, part of Ravenna's team only because of the support services of conveyance and healing they provided. Though both had faced serious danger on Eustace Majoris, neither were employed as a fighter or principal agent. Unworth had suffered badly. He had been tortured and mutilated at the whim of the infamous bounty hunter Lucius Vorner before Kiss had rescued him, but he had held out, loyal to them all.
One look at his hands showed the pain he had endured for them, and yet the likes of Carl still delighted in teasing and mocking. Carl. His name stung in her head as she thought of him. She frowned at the inexplicable strength of her own reaction. What had Carl ever done to her, except be an odious twit? She backed away. Unworth was telling Belknap some long and involved story about his own family history.
"It is much derailed, in places high and low,"
she heard the shipmaster saying.
"That there ever was a race of beings of the name the Squats, and many Skolams, and those of the High Mindful claim it's just a myth, a thing that never was, but my direst old Grand Avuncular sweared to me that the Unworth lineament had some tombra of that blood in it, right back in all perspective, I mean."
Kara had no wish to intrude. More properly, she wanted to speak to Belknap alone. She backed silently away. "Kara?" Belknap called, looking around from the table. Eyes in the back of his head, that one. The old vigilance of an Imperial Guardsman on sentry duty. "Just walking around," she shrugged. "Join us," Belknap said.
"Have a sniff of this here numbskull,"
Unworth smiled, jiggling the bottle.
"We are just of mindless confabulating."
"In a while, maybe. I've got to be on hand when the grid wakes up."
She walked away, following a side corridor down to the ship's infirmary. She turned on the lamps and began to search the scrubbed steel cupboards for a painkiller. Her head was really thumping. It couldn't be back. It couldn't be back, could it? Please, Throne. She stopped searching, aware that she was starting to hyperventilate. Panic, that wasn't like her. She leaned on the side counter, breathing deep and slow. Nearby, packed into its carrying modules, was the expensive medical equipment Ravenna had purchased on Eustace Majoris. Belknap had used it to diagnose her condition and monitor it. He still checked her once every fortnight or so. She remembered the last occasion, en route from Tancred. She remembered his delight at the improbability of her health. The same every time. His joy. How could she tell him? How could she ask? "Are you all right?" Kara switched around. Whiston Frauke stood in the doorway.
"Sorry, you startled me," she said.
Frauke shrugged. "I saw the light on in here. Are you all right?"
"Bit of a headache," she admitted.
Frauke dropped his half-smoked low-stick onto the corridor deck, ground it out with his heel, and entered the infirmary. He opened a glass-fronted cabinet and fished out a vial of capsules. "I find these work pretty nicely," he said.
"They're painkillers?"
He frowned, as if the question had never occurred to him. "I suppose. The blue ones there are a lot stronger, but they give you funny dreams and a dry thirst. These are what you might call headache strength."
"I didn't know you suffered from headaches," she said, taking the vial from his hand.
"Well," he began,
"suffering from headaches is something I would be sympathetic to," she said, "as opposed to, say, random secret experimentation with the infirmary's farm supply."
Frauke nodded sagely. "Then we'll call it headaches," he said, "and say no more about it. I was just trying to help." He stepped towards the door.
"Sorry," she called. "Sorry. Forgive me. I've got a real tension headache."
"Your life is quite boring, isn't it, Whiston?" The blunter shrugged. "It has its moments. They're usually brief and quite violent. The rest of the time... well, thanks for noticing." Kara pulled a glass of water from the scrub sink and rolled some of the capsules into her palm.
"Two?"
"I usually take 3 or 4, he said. He patted his thick chest sadly. "But then again, I've got more body mass than you, and usually very little to get up for in the morning." She laughed and knocked down 2 of the pills.
"How's the boy?" she asked.
"Why don't you come and see?" He led her down the short, linking companionway to the small wardroom adjoining the infirmary and surgical chambers. Only one of the 6 cots was occupied. Zale lay, pale and thin, in his endless sleep, attached to a feeder and biomonitor. Beside his cot, there was a single chair, and a cabinet on which sat a lamp, a data slate, and a bowl full of low-stick butts.
"Any change?" she whispered.
"Yeah. He woke up and started dancing. I forgot to tell you."
"Shut up,"
she scolded with a grin. "I won't half miss him when he wakes up," Frauke said with a sadness that surprised her.
Who's going to listen to my stories then?
Can they get you anything? She asked.
Frauke shook his head.
Well, good night. And thanks.
She left. Frauke wandered over to the chair and sat down. He lit a low stick and picked up the data slate, thumbing it live. The glow of the screen reflected on his face.
Where was I? He said.
Ah, yes. Her nipples were hard and pink with excitement. She squealed in delight as his loincloth dropped to the deck. Very slowly he...
Your nose is bleeding.
What?
Your nose is bleeding.
Damn it, Frauke said, moustaching his left index finger across his upper lip to staunch the flow. He put down the data slate, slid the burning low stick into the dish, and pulled out a handkerchief. He swabbed his nose and peered at the smeared linen. It wasn't the first time it had been spotted with blood. The old spots looked like rust. Not much. It stopped.
But your nose was bleeding.
Yes, so what? He tucked the handkerchief away again, sniffing.
Why?
Why? Frauke drew on his low stick. Why? You ask why?
I'm waiting for the answer.
Because it was.
Shut up. Noses bleed for a reason.
I'm sure they do. In my case, Sonny, it's because I picked it.
Both nostrils? Do me a favor, shut up.
I was reading.
I'm bored with the endless dirty stories.
Well, hey, I'm not, Frauke snapped. He raised the slate again. Her full breasts were as white and round as... He lowered the slate and gazed at the boy. You know what I have to do if you wake up?
Yeah. I can feel the weight of the gun in your pocket and the weight of the promise you made to the chair in your head.
Well, then. There was a long pause. Then Whiston said, I'm an untouchable. There shouldn't be any way you can feel anything in my head.
And yet...
Shut up. Where was I?
Something about breasts.
Right, yes.
You can't trust any of them anymore. You know that. So many dirty stories. So many secrets. Kara, Thonius, Balak, Nail.
So I won't tell anyone. Will you? The boy on the cot lay as still as death. Right. Where was I? She was making her way up the spinal corridor to the bridge when Belknap appeared.
Hi, she said. Still just walking around? He asked.
She nodded. Sholto's asleep. Too much numbskull. He's got some great stories. You know, he believes his family is descended from...
I'm scared,
she said abruptly. He looked at her. He didn't need her to tell him why. Come with me to the infirmary.
I can't. I have to go to the bridge. The grid's going to wake in 5 minutes.
All right, be calm. Check the grid. I'll go and set up, and then come and get you. She nodded again. Everything will be fine, he said. He took hold of her hands and folded them into the sign of the Aquila across her breasts.
Have faith.
He kissed her. She wrapped her arms around his neck as if she was going to break it.
10 minutes, he said, pulling away.
She walked in the opposite direction. Fiveflank was on the bridge, running some impenetrable system checks on the main helm. The manhound looked up and grunted when she appeared, and then carried on with its work. Kara sat down at the Vox station. She rubbed her eyes with both palms and drew a deep breath. The board lit up. Systems woke on automatic. Runes glowed, and then scrolled across the main comm screen. She waited for the graphics to settle down, and then keyed in the carrier signal. Nest wishes Talon, she typed. Above and starward, the voices of friends. A pause. Then letters typed out across the screen. Too tired for Glossier, Kara. Everything's all right here. We have a lead, a possible in. How are things up there? Everything's fine, she typed. Good. Talk to you again in 3 hours. Good night, Kara. Good night, Gideon. Chapter 4
Berenth is a dark, dirty, ugly hive, clamped to the southwestern tip of Utokri's second main landmass, ringed by 50 smoke-belching mine stations. This mass of industry and habitation, over 10,000 kilometers in area, cannot be seen from orbit. It cannot be seen by the Arethusa. This is due to Utokri's miasmal cloud cover. Most of the moon, land and oceans both, is ice-clad, and the atmosphere a dense, opaque cloud mass, thanks to an impact winter that has lasted 30,000 years. Astronomers blame the foul climatic circumstances on a past collision with a lesser moon. I sift and consider such facts to keep my mind turning. A moon itself, the eighth moon of 28, Utokri circles the well-populated imperial world of Saito at a great distance. Notably a claw-shaped new moon in Saito's winter skies, Utokri has a reputation as a dark place. The early settlers on Saito had invested Utokri with myths, suggesting it was a repository of evil, a place to which bad or twisted souls migrated after death. Perhaps it is a repository of evil. Certainly it has become a famous place. Nobility and the wealthy make pilgrimage to Utokri, usually on charter passage from the main planet. The ferries are regular, fecund with minerals, metals, and precious stones. Thanks to its complex and active structure, Utokri has become, over the years, a place of intensive ore mining and, secondarily, a center for lapidary craft. The rock seams under the moon's ice regularly yield the best uncut gems in the sector. All the key imperial jewelers and many hundreds of lesser halls have set up premises at Berenth, exploiting this resource. The sector's nobility come here to indulge themselves, partly because of Utokri's resources, and partly because it is exclusive. Only the very rich and the most nobly born can afford the prices and the effort of the ferry connection. But there is another service that Saito's 28th moon offers, for those who are very wealthy, or very superstitious, or very desperate. I have a bad feeling that I fall into the last category. It is a risk. The witch house was always going to be a risk. There have been so many attempts to find it and close it down over the years. It is elusive. It is well protected. It is dangerous. It is never wrong. Going to the witch house had been Carl's idea. I had blocked the notion to begin with until Balak weighed in with his support for it. I like Balak. I admire him. Perhaps that's why I finally demurred and brought us to Utokri. From the moment we left Tancred High Anchor, we were rogue. Not special condition, rogue. The word has a specific definition in the Inquisition's rubric. It denotes an agent or agents who are deemed negligent, insubordinate, and criminal. I have broken direct orders from my superiors. I have turned my back on an assigned duty. I have taken a mission upon myself without leave or permission. I have hidden myself so that I cannot be rebuked or stopped. Rogue. I never thought, never imagined myself in commission of such a sin. But this was my deliberate choice. On Tancred, on the very hour of our departure, Balak and Angharad had come to find us in secret. This was in the immediate aftermath of Moloch's bloody trap. Balak had come forward and offered his intelligence to me. He had not dared to go to Mizard. I had scanned the interrogator carefully, several times, with and without Balak's consent. The story was consistent every time, closing on Moloch with Fenks, being trapped and picked off one by one. Moloch jeering as he left Balak to his doom, cuffed to a turbine hub. Angharad arriving just in time to cut Balak free with her steel and haul him to safety.
"Moloch is alive," Balak had told me plainly. "He staged it all, so he could disappear behind a faked corpse." "You are right, sir. Moloch was here on Tancred, and now he's alive and free. The Inquisition believes he's dead. We were betrayed. Someone in the Ordos betrayed us. That's the only way Moloch could have known."
"And you come to me because..."
"Because, sir, you were right. And you're the only one I trust."
Moloch had escaped me too many times. Moloch had cost me too many times. Majescus. Oh, Throne, dear Will, and Nora, and Alina. The memory of their screams wakes me still. Too many times, Zygmunt Moloch, but not any more, even if it cost me my reputation and my career. Someone inside the Ordos betrayed Fenks to Moloch. Thus, a simple equation. The Ordos cannot be trusted. To finish Moloch, I have to operate without their support or knowledge. I have to move in secret and find Moloch before I am found. It was always going to come down to this. Moloch is my nemesis. He was always going to be the one to destroy me. Kara has just signed off. The Vox grid is dead again. She says everything is all right aboard the Arethusa, and I trust her, although I am still bothered by the mysterious secret she keeps. I stay awake and think. I listen to the constant ticking of my obsession. Am I breaking all the rules I'd swore I'd never break in order to do mankind a great service? A great service that only I am in a position to accomplish? Or am I just breaking all the rules? Either way, I fear I have led my friends into hell. I have doomed them all. The Inquisition is not forgiving. Kiss, Maud, and Carl are asleep. They are tired. I let them rest. Nail is somewhere, screwing the Carthayan. He thinks I don't know. I'm happy for him and for her, and I want to kill them both. Throne, I haven't felt this way for a long time. Not since the day I ended up in this box. It's quite enervating. Bastard. That you're screwing her, I don't mind. That you're hiding it from me, that I most certainly do. Did you think you were sparing my feelings? Did you? Did you? Chapter 5. The spoil wells lay deep under the hive, deep in the subterranean foundations below the permafrost. They were dank, badly lit rock-crete vaults, dozens of kilometers long, where the slurry from the mining operations was dumped on a regular basis. The air smelled of stone dust and moisture and raw minerals. A bitingly cold wind seeped in from the surface, invading through loading slips and drop shafts, and gusted around the numbered silos, raising a gray dust.
Hiram Lusik, Balak called out.
The man halfway up the spoil slope rose and looked down at them. He was skinny, but bulked up by furs and thermal body lagging, topped off by parts of an old hostile environment suit. He was holding a hand scanner unit. 5 rusty old prospector servitors sorted and scrabbled around him on the heap, tossing lumps of black rock into their battered panniers with corroded skeletal forelimbs.
Who wants to know?
We do.
A male and a female stood at the base of the heap. They stared up at him.
Yes, I'm Lusik, but I'm also busy. I've paid through the nose for 2 hours free sweep of this mass, and I won't waste a minute of that. We can go away and come back later, or just go away.
I think you'll want to speak with us, the woman said. We were told to ask for you. We need an introduction.
Lusik paused and glanced at the scanner in his hands. Pretty much nothing was showing. The spoil coming out of Deep 19 was poor these days. That probably explained why he'd got the free sweep at a knockdown. He sighed and slithered down the loose rock waste towards them. He moved with the expert tread of someone used to moving about on broken spill.
Go on, then, he said.
Close up, they didn't give much away, except that they were clean and well-dressed, which suggested money.
An introduction at Stein and Stein, Kiss said.
Lusik was an odd fish, thin and lean, just sinew and bone under his cold gear. His face was all cheekbones and jaw corners and a long blade nose. He had large eyes, which seemed to bulge from meager sockets.
An introduction? That's an expensive undertaking.
We understand that,
Balak said.
I know Stein and Stein, Lusik said. In my capacity as a prospector. They buy my stuff sometimes. Let's see. An introduction.
He did a little maths in his head, gauging them by their manner and their clothes. Too little, and he diddled himself. Too much, and he'd lose the job. He assayed the circumstances. He was good at assaying things.
Gonna be 2 or 3 minimum, he said.
100? Asked Kiss.
100,000, Balak corrected. Am I right?
Balak asked. Lusik nodded.
What you want is costly.
What we want is an introduction, said Kiss.
Let me get cleaned up, he said.
He rejoined them in a dirty public canteen, where the spoil well workers and prospectors met and rested. He had changed into a grey body glove and a fur-lined coat. There was still dirt on his hands. Balak bought 3 hot drinks and some wizened pastries from the stall. There was steam in the air and the rank scent of overworked heating units. Lusik sat down with them at a battered metal table, lit a low stick in his nimble fingers, and put an old data slate on the tabletop. Miners in bulky work suits shuffled past.
I need names, details, Lusik said. This isn't something you can just walk into.
So we found, said Kiss.
You don't look like the normal sort, Lusik said.
And what's that?
Nobility. The kind with nothing better to do.
What do we look like?
Lusik stuck his tongue in his lean cheek, so it bulged. He thought about it.
Trouble?
He suggested.
Look, the halls don't like to be mucked about. They have real pull here. Magistratum, Arbites, hell, even the Inquisition. That's a no-no. Especially the Inquisition.
I understand, said Balak.
What would happen if that was the case? Kiss asked.
You'd get dead, and me along with you.
Wouldn't that cause a problem? I mean, said Balak, if we were Inquisition, let's say.
Here? No, not really. Easy to hide a corpse or 3 here. The spoil smelters, the pack ice, the undersea, easy to get lost.
Well, we're not Inquisition, said Balak.
Or Magistratum or anything like that. But you've spotted we're not your regular type of clients, so we'd better come clean. Go on.
We're operatives working for a certain important individual. He has business interests in this sub, and he wants an inside track to guide his investments. There's a lot at stake.
And he trusts the house to provide that guidance?
Shouldn't he?
Oh, the house is good. Investments, eh?
Balak handed Lusik a data crystal. The prospector loaded it into his slate.
My name is Gaul, said Balak. My associate here is called Kine.
There was a pause while the slate hummed.
Link into the hive substrate, said Lusik. Just be a second. Gaul, Kine. There we go. From Eustace. Your bio work checks out.
It ought to, thought Kiss. The work Carl put in.
I think we can do business, said the prospector.
Well? Kara asked slowly.
Everything's good. There's no sign of any regrowth.
Belknap began to pack the medical kit away, carefully folding up the more delicate parts of the scanner. He looked at her. She smiled. They embraced.
I was so scared, she sighed.
So was I. When you came to me like that. Kara, my love, I don't want to scare you or jinx this, but you know you should,
what, be dead?
You should be dead. The woman I met and fell in love with on Eustace Majoris had barely 6 months. Then, overnight, just like that, the cancer went. I kept thinking I'd made a mistake, that I'd missed something, or it would come back. And when you came to me tonight... But unless I'm very bad at my job, it hasn't. It isn't there. No sign. You're clear. She got up. They were alone in the ship's infirmary, apart from Frauke and the comatose boy in the ward nearby. Unworth and Fifelank were up on the bridge.
Are you? Kara asked.
I'm a what?
Very bad at your job.
He laughed.
No.
She kissed his neck. Then she sat back.
What's that look?
He asked, reclasping his kit and carrying it to a wall locker.
I never told Ravenna. I kept it a secret. Now it's gone, but that secret inside me still remains.
What do you mean?
Kara shrugged.
I hated keeping it from him.
I trained myself to cover the truth. Now there's no truth to cover. It still feels like I'm covering for something. You've lost me, he said. She steepled her hands in front of her mouth thoughtfully and breathed out.
It's hard to explain. I feel like I'm keeping a terrible secret. But there's no secret left to keep.
The mind becomes conditioned, Belknap said. It gets used to what it gets used to. It'll pass.
I hope so. I wake up sometimes and feel I can almost catch what it is.
The secret?
Yes, the secret. It has something to do with Carl.
Carl? Kara sniggered.
I know, it's stupid. But why do I feel like I'm lying on Carl's behalf all the time?
Guilt, he said. Just your sense of guilt towards Ravana. Throne knows why that has attached itself to Carl. Do you know something about him that I don't? He's a pompous ass, he wears too many rings, and he's very good at his job. So no, then. She shrugged.
So why am I so muzzy, so clouded? Why have I got, Doctor, this pressing sense of unease, this forgetfulness?
Lack of exercise, he replied.
Right.
He paused and looked around at her. She knew that look. We're alone, you know.
Frauke's in the next room.
Oh, what does pawn boy care? He kissed her, dragged off her vest, and cupped her breasts with his hands. She pulled him down onto the infirmary couch.
Exercise, you reckon? She murmured.
Have you ever wondered just how much you can get away with before someone notices? Thonius asked. That's a curious question to ask, Ravana replied. They had gone up onto an observation bay high in Berinth Hive to pass the time while they waited for Balak and Kiss. With the dome shutters up, there was a considerable view of the ice-bound landscape and the belting, eternal storm. There was no one else around apart from a courting couple, low habbers at the far end of the rail. The place was like a temple to the elements. Thonius sat down on a metal bench beside Ravana's chair.
Have you, though? Carl asked.
Have you what? Maud Plighton asked as she joined them, carrying two metal cups of hot cecum she'd bought at a stall in the hallway outside the bay. She handed one to Carl and then sat down on the other end of the bench.
Thanks, Carl said. I'm intrigued, said Maud, sipping her drink.
Carl just asked me if I'd ever wondered just how much I could get away with before someone noticed, Ravana said.
That's a curious question to ask, Plighton said.
That was my response, Ravana agreed.
No, look, said Carl. We've gone rogue. I understand why we had to, and I support the decision. That's well and good. I just wondered how much you would risk. I mean, how much you would do in plain sight of others before you thought they would notice.
Mizard's people will be looking for any hint of our activity. So, very little is my answer.
It fascinates me,
Carl said, getting up. Subterfuge fascinates me. What a person can get away with, I mean.
You'd be surprised what a person can get away with, Maud Plighton said, in my professional experience.
Ravener's voxponder made a sound that indicated he was chuckling.
Oh, I think I wouldn't, said Carl.
He put his cup down.
Our work, sir. It's all about secrets, isn't it?
Keeping secrets, opening secrets up. Moloch, forgive me for mentioning his name, is so damn dangerous because of his ability to keep secrets.
Does a point come with that, Thonius? Asked Plighton.
I think so, Maud, Carl replied. He looked out at the storm.
It's not just keeping a secret, is it? It's about how you use it. What latitude you have.
Latitude? Asked Ravana.
Yes, sir.
What you say and what you don't say. It's not just about keeping the secret locked in. It's about having the strength and confidence to reveal your secret when you know it won't matter. That's an interesting notion, Ravana said. Develop it, Carl. Carl laughed.
We're in class now, are we?
We're in class till I say we're not, Carl Thonius, Ravana replied.
Fair point,
said Carl, although his face darkened.
For a start,
they say that liars have the best memories.
Old school law, said Blyton. First day on the job at interrogation, I learned that. Fakers need good memories to remember what they faked. You need a first-class memory to hold a false story together under inspection.
Sound magistratum advice, Ravenna remarked.
Yes, yes, said Carl. But a liar, a real liar, needs to vent himself sometimes, just to stay sane. He needs to confide or act openly when he's sure no one will notice. He needs to be able to get away with telling the truth once in a while, just to test the integrity of his deception.
You think Moloch might be so driven? Asked Ravenna.
He might. It's worth considering.
So noted, Ravenna said. That's good. That's good, clean thinking, Carl. Carl smiled.
Thank you, sir. I mean to say, what if a person did this right in front of you?
He waved his right hand. Plighton set her cup down and drew her sidearm out of her jacket. She cocked it and set the muzzle against the side of her head.
I think you're fretting, Carl, Ravenna said. The tension's getting to you.
Or this? Carl said, grinning. He waved his hand again. His hand was beginning to glow with a dull red light. At the far end of the platform, the courting couple was kissing. The man suddenly jerked away from his girl and floated backwards in the air towards the dome windows. She yelped, disbelieving, and stared at him. He was trying to cry out. His arms were flailing. He floated backwards and hit the glass gently, like a balloon. Then he went through the glass, like a hand through water. Outside, hanging there, he screamed. No one could hear him, although his lover squealed at the sight. The sleet storm shredded his clothes and slammed him against the glass. The constant barrage of the ice particles, like blades, shredded the meat off him in about 30 seconds. His skeleton, with gory strands of flesh and clothing still attached, with wounded organs still throbbing inside his ribcage, slowly slid down the glass, leaving a red smear, and dropped away onto the blackness.
I mean, said Carl, what about that?
The storm is quite magnificent, don't you think? Ravenna said. The primal quality of it.
You didn't see, did you? Carl murmured.
I did that, and you didn't see.
Well, that's something.
He looked at Maud Plighton.
Not today, he said.
She made her weapon safe and put it away. Then she picked up her cup and sipped again. Carl lowered his hand. It had stopped glowing.
That's good. Very good.
Plighton looked up.
Sir, why is that woman down there screaming? She asked.
Lusick walked into the hall, past the censers and the waiting servitors. He tracked muddy footprints across the worn bronze flooring.
Get out, we're closed, said Stein from behind the desk.
I've got an introduction to make,
Lusick said. He sat down on one of the leather couches.
Really?
Stein sneered across the desk.
Yes, really. You'd better stay sharp. Is it remunerative? Or is it like the last few losers you've brought in, Lusick? Stein and Stein is getting tired of your time-wasting. Neither. The Inquisition is onto us. Get ready.
Stein looked up sharply, suddenly interested.
The Inquisition? How do you know?
I was paid to know, said Hiram Lusick.
Chapter 6 Stein waited by his wooden desk in the hall's main chamber of display. He was nervous, his palms sweating. He began to pace. He stopped suddenly at the chime of a vox link in the shadows nearby. There was a brief crackle of muted transmission, and then a voice said,
Understood.
The red-haired man, who had been standing in the shadows, stepped into one of the pools of emerald light containing the chamber's showcases. He was slipping a link back into his pocket.
That was Lusick, the man said. They're on their way. 5 minutes.
I don't like this at all, said Stein.
You'll like the alternative even less,
said the red-haired man. Stein didn't know the man's name. He'd only met him an hour ago.
Are you ready?
This isn't the way it's done, said Stein.
The relationship between the halls and the house is very delicate. We don't abuse it. There's too much at stake. Our livelihoods,
Stein.
Listen to me. If these people are agents of the Inquisition, then they cannot be allowed access to the house. We are very strict about this.
What? You jewelers going to club together and take out an Inquisition team? I don't think so.
It's been done before, Stein said haughtily. I think you underestimate how zealously we protect our interests, or how capable the halls of Berinth are. Usually it doesn't come to that. We detect inquisitorial approaches and frustrate them with false leads or dead ends. Since the foundation of the Hive, no Ordo agent has got past us, or close to the house.
The red-haired man shrugged. It'll have to work differently this time. This is an exceptional case, and the halls of Berinth are most definitely out of their depth this time. Now, get ready. You have to play your part. We're paying you well enough. It's essential that these people believe they are gaining access to the house through the proper channels. If they suspect for a moment that there's been any funny business, well, then you'll have a problem.
With them?
With them, and with us, Stein.
Stein opened a desk drawer, took out a clean polishing cloth, and wiped his damp hands. He tossed the cloth into the back of the drawer and closed it again. He looked up at the red-haired man. No, he said.
I beg your pardon.
No, the factor repeated. I'm not doing this. Call it off.
It's way too late for that, Stein.
I don't care. I won't be party to this. The halls have far too much to lose to play this kind of game. You will not manipulate me. The red-haired man glanced towards the chamber entrance. 2 minutes left, maximum.
Damn it, he said.
He turned to face the factor and reached into his coat.
I don't want to have to do this, Stein. But you've backed me into a corner.
Stein's eyes widened. He took a step backwards, banging his hip against the desk. The man's hand was coming back out of his coat. Stein was expecting to see a weapon in it, a gun. The red-haired man was holding something far worse. It was an inquisitorial rosette. Lusik led Kiss and Balak along the promenade St. Jakob. Lusik had dressed smartly for the occasion, in a dark suit and a brown leather coat, both a little old, but respectable. He'd lacquered his hair. Balak and Kiss wore rather finer clothes, the image of understated wealth. Balak carried a small grey case. Lusik stopped a few hundred metres from the hall's main entrance and drew them over to the promenade railing. A steady flow of well-to-do and stately clients moved past them in both directions.
Now, said Lusik, follow my lead and do as I indicate. One wrong move, and you can forget everything. The hall will not tolerate games.
We understand, said Kiss.
I hope you do, Mamsell Kine, said Lusik.
He nodded at the case Balak was carrying.
Currency bonds? He asked.
Notarized wafers, Balak replied.
I trust that will be acceptable.
It damn well better had.
Kiss smiled to herself at the touch of Ravenna's mind in her head. It was reassuring to know that he was with them, and she knew he was right. Now they were operating rogue, Ravenna's access to funds was limited. Any access to fiscal holdings or trusts would flag them to the Ordos. They were living off Ravenna's fast-eroding personal resources, the small change he carried with him as an operating budget, and the 320,000 in Balak's case made a big dent in that reserve.
Wafers? That's fine, said Lusik.
You're getting anything on him?
Kiss said.
He's wearing a blocker, so no. I presume that's standard for a man in his position, although it concerns me. It's as if he was expecting a psyker. But we have to go through with it.
Good. Right. Of course.
Before you ask, I'm getting nothing off the hall, either. I cast ahead. The whole place is psi opaque. Fielding, I think. I'm not surprised by that, though. Standard security practice for a high-class jeweler is to be psi-blunted.
But you won't be with us once we're inside.
No, Patience, I won't. That's regrettable. Remember, though, the Emperor protects.
Well, if we're ready, and we're all clear, Lusik said.
As crystal, said Balak.
Let's do it, Lusik said.
You understand now?
The red-haired man asked. Stein swallowed and sat down hard.
The Inquisition?
Has enjoyed regular access to the house for decades, Stein, despite what the halls of Berinth believe. We just don't advertise the fact. The house can be very useful to us. So forget about keeping the Ordos out. We've been inside for years. Concentrate your mind on this particular deal.
The man stepped closer.
Stein?
Stein started and looked up. He was still reeling from the revelation.
Yes,
he murmured.
Yes. The people you're about to deal with are the principal agents of a rogue inquisitor. Do you understand? A rogue. A criminal. A mass murderer. He is very dangerous. They are very dangerous. Their actions have led to the slaughter of thousands.
Thousands?
Stein echoed. The disaster on Eustace Majoris 8 months ago. That was their doing. Stein shuddered. His hall, Berith, Saito, the whole Helican subsector was still reeling from the great trauma that had afflicted the capital world of the neighboring subsector. The economy was in spasm.
We're close, said the red-haired man quietly. But we need to get closer. We need them where we want them, so we can finish them. They're too dangerous to live. Do you understand?
I understand.
Good. I'm counting on you. Help us with this, and it will go well for Stein and Stein. I might even forget your recent suggestion that your hall and others might have eliminated Ordo agents in the past to protect your own interests.
Throne, I didn't mean...
Shush, Stein. Clean slate. That's what I'm authorized to offer you in exchange for helping us today. Do your part, give them what they want, and then forget anybody was ever here. Then the Inquisition of Mankind might forget about you, too.
Very well,
said Stein, rising to his feet.
Very well. I'll do it.
Do what?
The red-haired man asked.
Tell me again, clearly.
I will make them believe they are in, and that they are gaining access to the house through the proper channels. You can trust me.
Trust you, Stein?
The red-haired man laughed.
You deal in millions of crowns worth of precious metals and gems. The accumulation of wealth is all that concerns you. Men like you are cutthroat and mendacious, hard as corundum. I don't trust you at all, but I'm prepared to count on you this time. Do this, and do it well.
Stein nodded.
You can't be here.
I'll be in the next room, through there,
the red-haired man said.
If anything untoward occurs, I'll be ready.
Untoward?
Nothing will happen if you do your job right. We don't want it to happen here. I'm just saying.
A burnished servitor approached.
They're here, said the red-haired man. Get on with it.
Stein cleared his throat and walked slowly towards the door.
Where's the factor?
Kiss asked. They were standing in Stein and Stein's wood-paneled reception chamber. Lusik looked around awkwardly.
I'm sure he'll be along, he began.
We had an appointment, said Balak.
The factor should be here to greet us, said Kiss.
Lusik was clearly uncomfortable. Kiss noticed he was showing too much of the whites of his eyes.
Lusik?
The prospector shrugged an open-handed gesture.
I'm sure there's no problem.
Balak looked at Kiss. She nodded.
We're leaving, she said.
No! No, no! Just give him a moment, please.
This stinks, said Kiss. Thanks, but no thanks.
Throne's sake,
Lusik hissed.
This is my reputation on the line. My career. Agenting is where the real money is. I can't get by on prospecting alone, and if I blow this, Stein and Stein won't ever touch me again. And they'll spread the word to the other halls. I've put a lot into this.
So have we,
said Balak.
Please,
Lusik sighed.
My utmost apologies,
Stein cried, hurrying into the chamber towards them.
I am so sorry to have kept you waiting, even for a moment. A servitor was meant to summon me, and he was waylaid. 1,000 pardons.
Lusik looked sidelong at his clients.
We're all right,
he whispered.
Are we?
Kiss mouthed at Balak. Balak nodded. Lusik turned to the beaming factor.
dear Factor Stein, he said with a forced grin. Not quite the seamless greeting I had led my friends here to expect.
Stein bowed.
Oh, of course not. My dear old good friend Hiram, I will have the entire servitor complex rebooted. The lapse in decorum is unforgivable. I hope I can make amends. Refreshments, perhaps.
Always welcome, said Lusick, regaining his composure. May I present Master Gall and Mademoiselle Kine?
The factor came forward and bowed to each of them in turn.
A genuine pleasure. My dear old good friend Hiram has always brought the most distinguished emptors to Stein and Stein.
He looked directly at Kiss.
My lady, he said, I fear I was most awfully impolite to you on the occasion of our last meeting. I hope you will forgive my rudeness. We have to be so careful these days, and I quite misjudged you.
Kiss bowed back. Factor, I apologized then, and I apologize now. I should never have come to you so bluntly, without proper introduction.
Least said, soonest mended,
Stein replied with a cheery gesture.
Let's begin again fresh. Now, a little Amasek, perhaps. We have a last few casks of the Fibula 56, which I would keep to myself, truth be told, but I positively can't offer you anything less magnificent. And some birry truffles wrapped in nap leaves, and some local shellfish, I think. The scallops are prepared fresh by the hall's chefs, hoisted from the sub-ice ocean farms just 3 hours ago.
The scallops or the chefs? Asked Kiss. Stein brayed out a laugh.
The scallops, naturally. My lady has a fine sense of humour.
He clapped his hands and directed orders to the waiting servitors.
Shall we go in?
He ventured.
I have objects to show you.
They followed him back into the show galleries. His performance had begun. Kiss had heard it all before. To Stein's credit, it wasn't the same. She had to admit the factor was good at what he did. He stopped in front of a glass display of exquisite peridot and moonstone settings, in full flow, fluently describing every facet and cut. Stein stopped suddenly and turned to them with a smile.
Forgive me for babbling. I get quite carried away.
I ought to be telling you about the history of Stein and Stein.
Sometimes I forget myself. I am so enamored of my hall's work. I get quite incoherent. Does that interest you at all? He asked.
I think I speak for both of us, said Balak, when I say that coherence interests us a great deal.
Patience. Hello? We've got it. We're just leaving.
Lusick led them out onto the promenade. With a final bow, the factor bade them adieu.
An excellent choice, he said,
kissing Kiss's hand.
I hope so, said Kiss.
It's been a genuine pleasure spending this time with you,
Stein said, his performance drawing towards its curtain call.
You've been most obliging, sir,
Balak said to the factor with a bow.
If I can be of any further service,
Stein gushed.
My thanks again,
as ever, said Lusick. Stein bowed for the thousandth time and backed away into the hall. Kiss looked at Balak.
We're clear?
We're clear.
Thank throne, that's over, Kiss muttered.
Let's keep walking, Lusick advised. Come on now, briskly. I'm uncomfortable with you carrying that around in a public place. Even on the promenade St. Jacob, there are unscrupulous elements.
That was the 310,000-crown horologue piece that now occupied Balak's case. Kiss and Balak trailed Lusick down the promenade.
What happens now?
Kiss asked.
Depends. How quickly do you want it to happen?
Lusick asked.
Quickly. The next few hours.
Lusick nodded.
Good. It's better that way. The Q Stan sold me for the house has an expiry date. The house moves.
We understand that.
Fine. So long as you do. 2 hours, then, in Underbolt Pen 72. We can make the exchange there. How many people will be in your party?
No, said Kiss. We have our own transport arranged. You meet us.
That's not how it works, said Lusick.
It is now,
said Balak.
No, said Lusick. You'll screw this up.
It's how we want it, said Balak. Adjust. I'm sure you're capable. Boat pen 61, 2 hours from now.
Then I'm coming with you, said Lusick.
No, you're not,
Balak smiled. You want to use your own damn transport, fine, Lusik snapped. But I'm coming with you. You'll need me. Q or no Q, the house will blank you if you arrive in an unauthorized transport. You need me still.
You can get us in?
All part of the price. You have to take me along. Balak nodded.
Pen 61. 2 hours.